Previously.tv Podcast Network.
Those of us in the news media viewed Congressman Ryan as a form of protection, a shield of the United States. What happened there in those few moments made it clear that nobody was safe.
Congressman Ryan in question is not Speaker Paul, in fact, but the late Leo, murdered on an airstrip near Jonestown in Guyana in November of 1978. The True Crime Podcast in question is The Blotter Presents. This is episode 13. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents. I am unquestioning senior citizen Sarah D. Bunting, and I'm here with returning guest, basketball travel team escapee, Eve Beatty. Hello, Eve.
Hello, Sarah.
Welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Is this the ideal week to contemplate Jim Jones, a mad preacher whose myriad crimes included the shooting of a United States congressman? Maybe not.
Or how it's the day after the day after Father's Day, when it's, hey, Dad, if you want me to die, I will.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's so creepy. Anyway, in case you're not familiar, as we probably are a little too much with this set of crimes, it's an all cold case episode today, and we will be discussing Jim Jones and the murders at Jonestown in nonfiction form in an American Experience episode from 2009, and one in scripted form, the Powers Booth star Guyana tragedy, which was a TV miniseries in 1980. So, Eve, part of the reason that I wanted to have you back, aside from the fact that you're always a stellar guest, is because you are living in San Francisco, and I think would be able to speak a little bit better to the extremely rough week that San Franciscans had that week in November 1978. I realize you weren't living there then.
Well, but you know where I was living, Sarah? By 1978, I was living in an extremely rural part of Indiana, an extremely rural part of Indiana that I eventually left for the liberal ideas and the racial equality that I sought in San Francisco. So whether I like it or not, Mr. Jones and I have a lot more in common than I might want to admit.
Yeah, there are a lot of preachers in my family, half of which comes from Vincennes, Indiana, which is about as, you know, boring a part of India and escapable a part of Indiana as one might point out. Do not at me. But this was also the same week that Congressman Ryan was killed and everyone drank the Flavor-Aid.
Yep.
Again, we know it's Flavor-Aid. Don't at me. In Jonestown, or all this happened in Guyana, and then Harvey Milk was killed, what, 2 days later? 2 weeks later? It was real close, right?
It was real close, yeah. And the two things are obviously extremely connected because, as the American Experience documentary points out, if it weren't for the People's Temple and their canvassing for Mayor George Moscone, he wouldn't have been elected mayor. So in a certain sense, even though we can't say, oh, Jim Jones is responsible for the assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, you know, if you're going to butterfly effect things, you know, the People's Temple, you know, still had all this influence. And, you know, if you just keep spinning it even further, Sarah, which I'm about to,
please
you
do.
Know, so George Moscone and Harvey Milk are killed that short time thereafter. Dianne Feinstein becomes mayor of San Francisco and is sort of catapulted to national attention as a result of this high-profile slaying, and now has a political career that, what is it, this week she's saying she's unwilling to retire. And I think that we can argue that Dianne Feinstein, as a national politician, has had an impact on all of our lives. So the People's Temple, it's like impossible to sort of like, you know, underrate how influential they were, not just in San Francisco at that time period, but for all of us in the country.
Now, would you say, before we get into talking a little bit more about the American Experience episode, would you say that this is sort of, I don't want to compare it to 9/11 because there's like no comparing it and people's experiences are different, but I feel like even close to two decades later, that's something that is still sort of like dwelling as a sort of ticker at the bottom of like pretty much every New Yorker's daily life. Would you say that that these events and these deaths had a similar effect in San Francisco? Is it something that's sort of like part of the fabric of living there, is these tragedies?
Well, you know, maybe less so than New York. Our population is sort of so transitive. We get a lot of young people who move here and then move away. So it is, in one sense, for the people who've been here a long time, but there's also this huge sort of roving population of people who are San Franciscans, you know, for all intents and purposes. They pay taxes, they live here, they buy property, you know, they get knocked up here before they move to the suburbs, who don't, you know, get it at all. But I'll tell you this, when I first started my job a long time ago, well, not a long time ago, 2006, at the San Francisco Chronicle, I remember a reporter sort of using the phrase, drank the Kool-Aid, a young reporter, someone who, you know, had just gotten out of journalism school and this is maybe their first job. And not only in the A1 meeting, which is the meeting newspapers have every morning to sort of talk about the coverage of the day, Marshall Kilduff, who we see in that American Experience documentary, tore that poor kid a new one. But another time when that phrase actually slipped through the letters to the editor, and this is in 2006 when letters to the editor are already dropping off, but I mean, came by the buttload, because that phrase, just that casual use of that phrase, is one that will send San Franciscans of a certain age and a certain longevity into a rage.
Right.
Well, even though it was Flavor Aid, we all know,
yes,
don't add us.
Yeah,
we all know.
On top of everything else, Bish was cheap.
Well, but I mean, but the thing is, you know, it is one of those casual uses of phrase like anything else, like rule of thumb, where you don't think about the origins unless you come from a situation where, you know, where it has that sort of meaning. And so that to me is sort of the biggest example of it. It's like, God, don't say you drank the Kool-Aid in mixed. It's a cliche anyway. Don't use it because it's a cliche.
Yeah. And then what it ends up meaning, like once you realize the truth of what was happening on the ground, then what people use it to mean is not even accurate. Well, I was going to disappear up my own butt with more questions about whether when it comes to crimes, these or the Zodiac are more influential in terms of the San Franciscan consciousness. But speaking of newspapers, I think we should listen to our first clip just to get into like the sheer bizarreness of Jim Jones's origin story when he still had a congregation, like early days in Indiana.
Oh, yeah.
I think the fact that he used to kill small animals so that he could perform funerals for them tells you pretty much everything you need to know about what's going to happen. Like the seeds of destruction were always present. But here's this story from a former churchgoer, which raises many more questions, in my opinion, than it answers in clip two.
The first time I met Jim Jones was Easter 1953. My mother-in-law, Edith Cardell, had a monkey and it hung itself, and she wanted to replace the monkey. So she looked in the Indianapolis Star, and in that Indianapolis Star was Jim Jones's ad that he had some monkeys to sell. So it was through that she met Jim Jones and came back saying that he'd invited her to church this next Sunday.
I mean,
so here, my note here is, when back home, ask about monkey markets.
Yeah. Was that a thing? Like where exactly in the like want ads did you look for a replacement monkey?
Well, I mean,
monkeys have their own section? Was it just like non-standard pets?
I mean, and not that I don't want to leap forward, but obviously we get a lot of monkey screen time in the fictionalized version of this too, far more than perhaps I would have liked. But no, I mean, I have a lot of questions about the monkey market. Like, I want to know the whole sort of supply chain for monkeys. Like, where are these monkeys that are these like Mexican monkeys or like Indiana is the crossroads of America. There are a lot of freeways that were going through Indiana, like even, you know, by the 50s. So I suppose, like, are you taking the freeway up from somewhere? Are they coming from Canada? Do we need to build a monkey wall, Sarah?
I don't know. And who's going to pay for that? Not Jim Jones, I guess. My question is he breeding them or is he at, like, monkey way station? Is he the guy who knows a guy and he brings you to the monkey? Is there a monkey stash house? Like,
what
on
kind
the wire?
Of monkeys were they?
Yeah, I don't know a lot about monkeys. I'm not one of those monkeys are automatically funny people. Like, I saw Project X on a plane. I cried hysterically. I was coming back from San Francisco, actually. I've kind of been off the, you know, monkeys as pets thing ever since. But that this, like, and then they show a picture on the screen of him. Like, you can see it on our Twitter account this week at Blotter Presents, but he just looks, it's like he's got them by the nape and he's sort of, he looks like he's making them talk to each other like they're puppets, which, and I don't know, like something about it is creepy to me over and above all the rest of the creepiness attendant on Jim Jones.
Well, and it just like, I'm just curious about, like, where do you get monkey kibble? What were these monkeys eating, too? You know, like, I need to get into this monkey thing more. And that's not one of those things that any time I've sort of been thinking about Jones, I really devoted a lot of attention to. But it is the first thing that leapt out at me, too, when watching this documentary.
Well, and I do wonder if it was one of those, you know, to coin a phrase, like, grooming things that he was doing to sort of like, well, the people who are looking for monkeys are the kind of people who are going to be a little more forward thinking about an integrated congregation and stuff like that. So maybe it was all a ploy to like pull people in, like, you know, come for the monkeys, stay for the churching. I mean,
you know, or maybe he was just into monkeys. Hitler loved dogs. I mean, it could be a completely separate sort of, he did, you know, but he could have just,
Blondie.
He's a person, right? He could have just been into monkey stuff. And I have certainly, and you have too, done things where I've pretended my pets are talking to each other.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, so. Oh my God, I sound like I'm defending him, Sarah. I'm sorry. You guys, don't at me. I'm not defending Jim Jones. He's a monster.
it's hard to imagine, given what we had heard earlier, that there was not some ulterior monkey motive behind his, quote, monkey shines behind his monkey business. But, and, you know, since we're into the, you know, monkey business portion, let's just address, I think this is what I called in our episode rundown, the super classy Jim Jones's weird download sex shit section.
Yeah.
We're going to have to get into it at some point. They also sort of brush past this bit in American Experience where he has this like, he has this sermon he gives apparently repeatedly about how everyone is gay except him. And which I think was probably a dual function kind of like mini psychological test to A, cover for his own predilections, which likely had nothing to do with attraction to a given gender and everything to do with power. Mm-hmm. And number two, a way of leveling the whole congregation with the same received shame, the better to control them. See, number one. But yeah, he carried on adulterous affairs. He offered to have anal sex with congregants that didn't even know he knew who they were. Raping people and telling them it was for their own benefit. Let's listen to clip three, in which a woman talks about how she met Jim Jones and the familial relationship that pertained.
He was carrying on an adulterous relationship with my sister. And because his wife couldn't relate to him as a wife, that Carolyn had taken over that role. Everything was plausible, except in retrospect, the whole thing seems absolutely bizarre.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think, Jim Jones's evil genius.
Mm-hmm.
That the plausible, and then when you look back at it, you're like, what?
But it's also sort of like every garbage guy's ploy. Oh, you know, things aren't working out with my wife. She's frigid. You know, she's whatever, and that's why we need to be together. I mean, it's just Jim Jones, in my opinion, is like sort of like every aspect of toxic masculinity, but writ incredibly large, except for the monkey stuff, which is just weird. But I mean, all of this stuff, once again, that it was, you know, the way he manipulated women into appearing to consent to have sex with him, even though it's clearly, they are clearly were in no position to consent.
And yeah, often telling them that it was for the good of their drug addicted husbands in recovery, mm-hmm. which we will get to in our second section, the scripted section. But here's a congregant talking about how Jim Jones was like, we can do it in the butt if you want. Clip four.
Jones happened to be coming out of his room and he said, "Hi, Tim, how are you doing? How's it going? How do you like everything so far?" And, "Oh, I like it a lot. And, you know, it's really cool. I don't remember exactly." And he reached up and kind of patted the back of my neck and he said, "I'll fuck you in the ass if you want."
Oh.
And I just kind of stammered, "No, you know, no." And he said, "Well, you know, if you ever want that, that's okay. You know, just let me know and we'll do that."
Thanks, Dad.
But I mean, this does pose another question. But how? I mean, because these are people who were in the church. This documentary, the documentary that we're talking about, I think was from 2006, is that right?
2006. I think I saw it in 2009, but you're right. It's from 2006. And because I completely neglected to mention this, it's called Jonestown, The Life and Death of People's Temple. And we will have the YouTube link in the show notes. Sorry, continue.
No. But, you know, it's sometimes I do think, especially when we're talking about witness accounts of a situation as horrifying and as insane as this, is how reliable do we believe our narrators to be? I'm certainly not suggesting that this person, you know, did have sex with Jim Jones or anything like that. But it's something that I always like to encourage people to sort of consider when they're hearing all these stories. I'm not saying, oh, you know, Jim Jones is a great guy and these people are all making it up or anything. But when everyone is the hero of their own story. And sure. So when people are telling these stories and they're always sort of just like, and then I looked around and I was like, what's going on? I always think to myself, really? Because you were there. You were in it. I don't know. I mean, I felt like I had to throw it out there because that line in the documentary especially rang a little tough for me. Not in the sense that I don't believe that Jones was, you know, omnisexual and, you know, and screwing everything that moved for exactly the reasons you describe. I, for some reason, found the sort of a casual, you know, Jones was willing to have sex with everyone on the basketball team if they had enemas first line a lot more plausible than that sort of encounter. I'm not sure why.
Well, there's something, here's what rang true about it to me. Like, it did ring a little false because of the profanity, which is a strange thing to say under the circumstances, but I feel like Jim Jones was one of those guys that was like fundamentally amoral, except when it served his purposes, but mm-hmm. also would have been quite prim about like personal hygiene and not swearing mm-hmm. and stuff. So that, like, I'll fuck you in the ass if you want. Like, I don't think he would have put it like that.
It just felt too casual. It felt too rock star, you know, backstage to me. And less, I think that Jones was calculating, even though he was mentally ill, he was still calculating every move. And that, to me, felt too casual.
Yeah, but my argument, I mean, you could be right. I have not been in a cult. And, we can't ask him what he was thinking, of course. But I think there's also the argument that charismatic leaders or cult leaders or sociopaths who are bent on manipulating people do have a sense of when it's time to suddenly turn up the heat.
Good point.
And test people and mm-hmm. see, because it's like, you know, I think it's like a, this is an unfortunate turn of phrase, but a peacock display.
Sure.
For their own benefit to be yeah. like, I can push this boundary crazy hard. Mm-hmm. Also a poor turn of phrase. There aren't going to be any good turns of phrase. Sorry, nope. people. It's Jonestown. That just to see like how under my control is this man mm-hmm. that I can suggest something so outre mm-hmm. and just be like, okay, well, if that's something you want to do, all right, later. And then like if you see him at services the next day, then you could sort of get off on that psychologically. Like I would argue that that was part of a, that that's part of a, how people groom, like how sociopaths groom their victims and
sure.
that's just part of it. But
okay.
yeah, it was a little like in a series of rather sort of shocking and repulsive details about Jim Jones's various exploits. That one did stick out a little and not necessarily in a believable
yeah.
way. Now I guess it's time to address the matter of Debbie Layton. Let's hear a clip from her first.
And as I lay there, frightened, not sure what to do, and as I shivered, he'd say to me, "This is for you. I'm doing this for you, Debbie."
He had just called her back into his, like, fuck pad in the back of the traveling bus and had sex with her, not really with her consent, basically. Mm-hmm. I have read Layton's memoir. It is poorly done. Particularly, she tries to replicate African-American dialect in the writing, and it's mortifying at best. I'm sure she means well. She does give some good insights into how people stay in that kind of situation, even when it's clear that whatever good intentions Jones may have had have long fallen by the wayside, so that he can manipulate seniors out of their houses and wallow in his own paranoia. She's kind of a sort of problematic witness because she was so high up in the temple structure, and like, I don't know, her memoir is very like, it goes back to what you were saying before, like she is definitely the hero of that story, and it can be a little hard to plug into her experience. Did you find that at all?
Well, she is another one of those people where for me, it felt like she had told these stories many times. And
yes.
I think, and this is true for you, this is true for me, this is true for anyone. When we tell a story, especially of a traumatic event, we're constantly editing it. And it's not because we're deceptive, but we just are. And we're editing it and we're tailoring it. And the more time that passes between, you know, this initial event and, you know, our telling of it now, the more sort of, you know, fictionalized for TV it becomes. And so it's like hard to, my gut doesn't even feel anything with it, because she's clearly told this story, you know, thousands probably of times. So there isn't any sort of, compared to like Stanley or someone who felt so genuine to me, or Mike, uh-huh. which sub note, Mike, in that footage from back in the 70s, I'm just saying, wow. Wow, Mike. Wow. But I'm sorry, that's so inappropriate, but Mike was a freaking dreamboat. But it, you know, compared to some of them, everything was so practiced and so polished that it's hard to feel like she's telling you the truth. And that's not her fault necessarily, but it's just how it is.
Well, I really like this documentary generally, but you can, there are sort of two types of talking head interviewee. Mm-hmm. There is the type like Stanley, who I don't think has been asked for his take on things a gazillion times and has not sort of made, not that Deborah Layton and her fellow survivors are like making a cottage industry of being survivors. I think they really are trying to help other people in their situation and also try to sort through what happened to them. I don't think it's cynical at all, but yeah, they know how to give soundbite and they know that that's what they're for. That, like, that's why they've been asked to participate. So,
well, didn't even Jackie Speier feel more genuine to her? And Jackie Speier is a politician, and she's a career politician. She's been a politician since this time, and arguably one of the reasons that she had sort of the name recognition that enabled her to become a politician was because of this experience. But when she was speaking, she didn't feel like a polished politician. She did, and I don't know, I mean, I've been in the same room as Jackie a couple times. I don't know her personally. But she, in this documentary, she didn't sound like the Jackie that I know from the TV or the news or press conferences or anything. She sounded like a person. And
right.
So I feel like, you know, that's like, she was not in the cult, though. She's just retelling her experiences within a very narrow period of time, you know, visiting, you know, the place and then getting shot.
Right. Yeah, I thought they did a good job at mixing up those two types, though, because you do want, like, monkey-baited congregant who, like, that story isn't neat. And, like, the corners sort of don't fit. It doesn't exactly make sense. Like, we talked about it for, like, 10 minutes. So that's compelling. But then you want also the guy that we heard up top, the journalist who is a little better versed in what a documentary producer is looking for in terms of, like, putting a little bow on it. Our next clip actually splits the difference with that fairly well, because it feels sincere and not rehearsed, but it also explains a little bit why people are surrounded by increasing outrage and the frogs do not climb out of the pot in clip six.
I couldn't say goodbye to my son and my husband because at that point it was like the Gestapo. The families were turning in each other. If I had said goodbye, one of them would have reported me.
It's kind of like when you get married and you have this ideal and you're in love, and then, you know, the honeymoon wears off and reality sets in. And most people, once it's the going gets rough, don't jump out immediately.
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, I think that, you know, I'm so glad that you pulled that clip too, because not that everything is about these troubled times, but, you know, and not just because we did have this horrific shooting happen in this country last week, but there are so many things about this entire situation that feel so current to me that I'm glad that you chose this topic for right now. From arguably the idea that this is a situation where a lefty, because that's how people are describing it, right? You know, that this is like, you know, since I moderate comments on a news site, you know, I see this all the time. The violent liberals, I see comments on this all the time. The violent Bernie Sanders supporters. And here's the thing, you know, you talk about the whole idea that the People's Temple was ostensibly founded upon, which at one point was perhaps genuinely intended before Jones's mental illness, you know, got the better of him. You know, this whole idea of racial equality and of integration was such a, you know, an astounding idea in small town Indiana. And, you know, even though we can say, oh, you know, San Francisco's a lot more liberal, I can tell you right now, there's a huge amount of racial divide in San Francisco to the point where even when, you know, Jones first got here, Black people were being driven out of, you know, the sort of the areas where Jones was practicing. And things in San Francisco in terms of sort of racial demographics have only gotten worse since then. You know, so all this, that he had these liberal ideas that weren't to contrast with another person that he's obviously frequently spoken in the same breath as, with Charles Manson, someone else who came from the Midwest, was in San Francisco for a while before, you know, he did his dreadful crimes also south of here. You know, compare that with Manson, who his whole thing was, you know, there's going to be a race war and Whitey needs to be on top. Jones, you know, he had, quote unquote, the right idea that Black people and white people are human beings who should coexist. And so to me, it's just so interesting that, you know, when we talk about this whole thing where when you're with Jones and the crazy stuff gets normalized because you're in it, is also, you know, I think how we feel about so many things in this culture now.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that it's instructive, as my husband put it, when I was sort of like, well, should I run that clip up top and should I put a trigger warning? Like, this is a little weirdly timed. And he's like, I think it's actually really relevant right now because, you know, nuts gonna nut was his quote. But it does feel really relevant now because you do have this charismatic leader who I think, you know, both sides sort of want to classify and label what they're seeing as chaos in power because it makes it feel more manageable. But the fact is, on a human scale, it's not about any like left or right. It's not about Bernie bros. It's about a couple of people who are like psychologically not fit to be in charge of a congregation, of a country.
Of San Francisco's housing authority, which, you know, Jones was. And that's the thing, too, that, like, when we're talking, Jim Jones arguably had more political experience than our president.
I would not argue that. I think he clearly did.
I mean, he was there. He was in meetings. He was at Board of Supervisors meetings. He was at Housing Commission.
And was better at real estate, too.
Oh, well.
I mean, he was, you know, a crook, but at least he was good at it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He was making hella bank. But he also was doing, I mean, San Francisco's Housing Authority has been in worse shape than it was under Jim Jones. So, I mean, again, it's like this weird duality. There was this idea, I mean, and you see a little bit of it in the American Experience sort of documentary, but so Willie Brown, who is in a lot of ways sort of San Francisco's most enduring mayoral figure other than perhaps George Moscone. But so Willie Brown, you know, is a former mayor who's still around. He has a column in the San Francisco Chronicle right now. He's at every party. Willie Brown is there. And Willie Brown was one of Jim Jones's biggest supporters, biggest fans at the time. Jim Jones was a part of our our societal fabric in San Francisco, the way, the leader of a normal church, popular priest or, you know, an archbishop or something, you know, might be in Boston or New York. And so, right. You know, and that's one of the reasons that when Marshall Kilduff's piece, appeared in New West magazine, even though I will point out that Tim Reiterman was writing pieces way before that. So it annoys me a little bit that American Experience credits it to Marshall, but Marshall's a great guy. So whatever, it all works out. But, you know, it was the New West piece that sort of convinced him to, you know, pack up and leave San Francisco literally overnight. But, you know, it's so interesting to me, this idea that, you know, one magazine article in print was enough to sort of impel this.
Well, and you also, this is something that you see in books about Scientology too.
Yeah.
There was like one particular article, I guess in, it was either Life or Look, that L. Ron Hubbard was like, fold the tents, set them on fire, you know, call them Thetans, and we're, you know, I'm going to get on a boat and live on a boat in international waters.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
It's so like, there's is there
definitely that sense of like dislocation? Like, I think it's hard to like get your arms around how crazy what happened was. Like, it's really a lot of people who died.
Yes.
Horribly in a very short amount of time. And then they just like, you know, unloaded these machine guns on the congressman and his traveling party. It's hard to get your arms around it. But then again, I feel like this every day these days looking at Twitter. And my father talks about feeling this way, like reading the news today, but also having felt that at the end of the 60s and just feeling like, what is it going to be next? Like, where is safe?
Or my father-in-law, who is German and who was very young but still remembers World War II. And, you know, the night of the election, he called us crying, saying, I didn't think that I'd ever live to see this again. And, you know, so far, no one's being loaded on trains yet. But, you know, I feel like, you know, you and I, Sarah, you know, I was like, whatever, like, 7 or 8 when this happened. I sort of remember my parents talking about it, but, you know, it wasn't part of my life. I can only imagine how this must still resonate with people our parents' ages.
Yeah, I was, I would have been 5 and a half. My brother would have been a newborn. So I can imagine that I was herded out of the room if there was any mention of this.
I feel like there was a 60 Minutes where that was on right after it happened, where they talked about Jones like pulling fake tumors out of people's bodies and it was like actually rotten meat or something. So strongly remember that 60 Minutes, like, because, you know, I'm like you, where I wasn't allowed to watch fun TV, just like PBS and the news. And I think about that right now. Like, why didn't they just let us watch Dukes of Hazzard, Sarah? Because
seriously,
letting us watch the news, look at us now.
Yeah, I was allowed to watch, like, when Reagan was shot, I was allowed to watch that crazy shit unfolding.
They called me in from playing outside to watch that.
Oh, my God.
I was in the yard. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, all right, well, let's wrap up this section. And before we play this last clip, this is the clip that has stayed with me for years. I think this is what, like, not necessarily elevates this documentary, but makes it the harrowing as it is, one of the gold standards of any material about this, because this audio, I mean, this was not a, like, peaceful slip through the veil death physically, and hearing children and infants going through it in the background while this psychotic person, who is probably also on cocaine, not for nothing, is prating on about their revolutionary mission, is profoundly depressing. And if you feel that you might find this too upsetting, you are urged to mute your audio for about a minute. Clip 7.
We made it down. We got time. We didn't commit suicide. We committed an act of revolutionary suicide protesting the conditions of an inhumane world.
Just that baby crying at the
yeah.
end. Like, yeah. And as you know, I'm not a kid person, but Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Like, how... It's just one of those things that you listen to it and you're like, how did this happen? This can never be allowed to happen again. So as a sort of document that we can all, you know, whose testimony we can all hear and try to prevent this from happening if we see it happening around us to people we love or even know slightly, I think it's worthwhile. But if you have never seen this documentary, it's about an hour and 18 minutes in. This when they begin to document the deaths, and it's rough.
Yeah.
It's effective, but it's rough.
It is. And it makes it so, as opposed to a lot of the things that you've covered on this podcast, where even though it's terrible when people die, crime is horrible, violence is horrible, but there's something about this that there's no way to approach it in sort of a, you know, crime is fun sort of way. There's no way. This is not fun.
Yeah, no, it's not. I mean, sometimes this is always the struggle with covering true crime and like reviewing it, that you're right on that line between, you know, I hope everyone listening understands that the assumption that, like, of course, all these crimes are horrible. Crime is horrible. That's why we call it crime and not candy, and they're not synonyms. But my goal with The Blotter has always been to review the stories about the crime. And as these go, this is like Dear Zachary. I can't exactly recommend it. It's a tough sit, but it's also a fitting tribute to, you know, what happened and trying to prevent it. So let's move on to a slightly less successful and more mockable take on the events at Guyana. It's called Guyana Tragedy, the story of Jim Jones. This aired in 1980. And starred, among other people, Powers Booth.
It starred everyone. Everyone is in this.
Ned Beatty as Ryan, which I was like, what?
But oh, I've got notes
really
about this.
He's really good in it. Okay, well, why don't you start? Because I have a few clips and some questions, but why don't you begin with some Beatty Anna that you need to get off your chest?
Well, no, I like Ned Beatty. I think he's great. You know, he's the best Superman sidekick, whatever. You know, Deliverance is terrific. But I just thought, given all of the great, tall, gray-haired actors working in the late 70s and early 80s, you pick Ned Beatty, who, you know, always, God bless his heart, has that under air of sort of like officious Porky Pig, you know?
Yeah,
kind of. When you watch the American, this is one of the few times where you see a fictionalization that chooses someone who is so much less attractive than the actual real life person. You know, when you watch the American Experience documentary and you see, you know, Ryan, he got stabbed and he's getting out of the camp and he's trying to make it to the tarmac. And, you know, forgive me for saying this, but he cuts a very, even though it's serious, a very glamorous figure. There is nothing glamorous about Ned Beatty ever. So I'm just so curious. He must have really wanted this role and known somebody. That's all I can figure.
Yeah, maybe that's why he couldn't make it. That was around 1980, in fact. And
yeah.
Maybe he was Bensoning or Shakespeare-ing. Who knows?
Yeah. And I do think that he has the chops for it. I mean, Ned Beatty was arguably sort of at the peak of his career at that time. So he was a great get. And I mean, like, everyone else is in this, you know, Veronica Cartwright, like you said, James Earl Jones in a small role.
Yeah.
Irene Cara.
Oh, God. Yeah, I forgot about that.
I mean, everyone is in LeVar Burton, of course, once again, who was sort of, on the upswing at that point, too. And he had a great sort of, he was obviously an amalgam of a lot of those guys that we saw in the American Experience documentary.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about Powers Booth's fitness for this role, which I think is not exact. Like, I think he starts off well and then... Okay, well, let me back up a second. We talked a little bit earlier about the idea that this sort of diverse, integrated, one family concept for a congregation did seem to be sincere at first.
Yeah.
What's fascinating to me about Jones at this distance, and what I never quite see addressed to my satisfaction in any materials about him, I guess that's like... part of the allure of this story is that, like, we're never really going to know, is it seemed to have begun as a sincere effort to be inclusive, but then Guyana is as eager as any property I've seen to underline what a piece of shit the racists were, and what a hero Jim Jones was, but then it never quite gets into when the turning point was, like, and when it became... sort of a, not a killing field, but like when his congregation became targets instead of a congregation.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this is a very PSA scene about what Jones was dealing with in Indiana. Warning, N-words, ahoy. Clip 8.
I just want to get a haircut for my mama's burial.
And you ain't going to get it here. Just a minute. You think you're doing? You hear what he said? He wants a haircut for his mama's funeral.
I don't care if he wants it for his own funeral. I ain't gonna cut no nigger's hair here.
Difference does it make? He's a little boy. Haven't you got any feelings? We're all the same in the eyes of God.
This ain't God's barbershop, and it ain't gonna be mine either if I use my tools on that nigger's head.
And it's not mine either, now or ever. For this is the house of the devil, and those that abide here are cursed. Come on, son, let's get out of here.
I mean, I'm sort of like Jim Jones. You live in Indiana. Are you surprised? But I mean, A, it's middle school play level stuff going on here, too.
Oh, yeah. And the blocking alone, which you can almost hear him snatching off the drape in the barber's chair and getting up to declaim. But yes, sorry, continue.
But also, anyone who's watched This Is Us knows that if you're with a black kid, you take the kid to a barber who knows how to cut black hair. So Jim Jones is fucking up from the get-go. But, you know, but like that he's surprised. The thing is, this is a scene that you could see played out in certain parts of Indiana right now. That's not great. I'm not defending it. But I'm just saying that if Jim Jones, who was born and raised in really, I mean, not a great part of Indiana, as if there are good parts, you know, that he is somehow that he's coming at this sort of cold. I mean, how about a bus? How about a lunch counter? How about any, you know, how about Jim Jones looks around wherever he's working? Like, it's not like there are black guys working at the hospital with him. You know, I don't know, maybe there were in the janitorial staff, but that this was sort of news to him. That, I mean, obviously it wasn't. Obviously the scene is put there to explain to us.
Well, and we've seen, yeah, and we'd seen several scenes prior in which his alcoholic dad, played by Ed Lauder, total hey, it's that guy, is like dropping N-bombs all over the place.
Yeah.
Like, this attitude is, you know, and people have speculated that Jim Jones was so welcoming to people of color and seniors because he knew what it was like to feel alienated in his own world. I think it was probably more of a setup than that. But yeah, this scene was really like, you know, he did do a couple of good things. He probably did them motivated by like evil, and let's not make too much of like Jim Jones' integration hero, shall we? Especially not with this acting.
But this is a problem. This is a problem with this, and it was a miniseries, right? It was two parts.
Yes.
This is a problem with this miniseries. Is I think that, which was ambitious to its credit, but that they couldn't decide, you know, how to, if you're going to spend 3 hours with this guy, he can't just be, you know, completely, I guess, awful, maybe they decided. And so they chose to make him sympathetic in parts in scenes like this, in other scenes. And I think we're probably going to get to some of the sex stuff in a minute, but this is another area where I feel like the tone is so off, because I feel like we need to be reminding people when we make something like this that this guy is a bad guy, and not be like, hey, you know, he was a person too.
Well, and I sort of feel like this got made, or sort of like was able to be made at this time in TV history for a network because they agreed not to get too sensational with the deaths and focus too like exploitatively on the like the payoff, for lack of a better word. So in order to keep people watching for 4 hours over two nights, I can imagine they felt obligated to be like, well, this is how it, you know, it started out as a good idea and here's how it all went wrong. So there's that problem, which is like, let's face it, like narratively, no one's all that interested in how he used to be a good guy occasionally in some ways. And B, I loved Powers Booth. May he rest. He's creepy enough to play Jones, but there's a little bit, this goes back to the like different charisma thing I was saying before. He's a little too conventionally handsome, in my opinion, to convey Jones's like fatuously nasal, overweight huckster guy. Like, I don't know. And like, his acting is good. It's rather restrained under the circumstances, and especially compared to a couple of his co-stars, LeVar Burton. But he's not quite right, because I feel like whoever's playing Jones, you should still be like disgusted by what he's doing. But when he's like trying to get Christina Crawford to sleep with him to get Billy Babbitt off drugs, you're kind of like, yeah, I might.
Well, but I think that part of it that sort of set us up for the yeah, I might too, is that we see these sex scenes and they are played for titillation and not even like uncomfortable titillation. They're definitely played sexy. Like, you know, it's not quite Dave and Maddie, will they or won't they? But there's a little bit of that, right? You know, it, and ironically.
Or, no, there is a little bit of like, I got more of a Thornbirds like scandal. Oh. It is forbidden.
Well, yeah, yeah. And that's, I mean, and that sort of matches with the sort of the time period, right? Because wasn't Thornbirds like probably around that time too? Yeah,
probably had aired right before that. Actually, let's listen to a clip because clip 9, I think the scandalized music cue at the end sort of goes into what we're saying here.
In this place, this heaven that you've almost single-handedly created, I think is one of the most beautiful things that I've ever seen.
Giving no wire so hangers.
We must all give her love. And everything we have. Hmm? You could help me. Help me to make a better life for David.
Anything.
I'm asking you to be close to God. Close to me.
God is my penis.
Don't you see that by giving to me, you're really helping him? He needs me now. And I need you.
They're kissing.
What about the part
that
where he
went on for a while too and was like, oh no, but he's married. Like, well, that's not exactly the only problem.
That's exactly it, is that it seems like it's more like the sad music of infidelity and not like the sad music of like, he's a monster and, you know, you don't know what you're doing and you're being manipulated into relations with this man kind of non-consensually. They play when he gets with Meg Foster also, that it's sort of this sweeping romantic moment. And then there's the whole sort of like, what's going on with him spending the night with Brad Dourif? Like, he's helping him get off horse, but he's got the shirt off and he's propped up on one arm in bed. And it's like, I know all the cues here. I've been watching television for a while. This is a morning after scene.
Yeah. Well, and yeah, we also all saw Making Love starring Harry Hamlin, and
perfect.
That's how you were allowed to signal homosexual congress.
Yeah.
Back in 1980. So, But then that was also, you're right. That same sort of like the, you know, sad Piccolo is sad that they can't be together. Like, okay. Okay. Like, it wasn't particularly scandalized that they were both men, but it was also like, but this is, yeah. And then, I mean, Brad Dourif, I thought, was really good in this. And did seem at the end to, like, while he was still a collaborator, did seem to have some doubts about what he was doing to others, at least in terms of giving people unauthorized injections, but maybe I'm wrong about that.
Well, and I didn't quite pick up if the fictionalization suggested that he was a survivor, because you sort of see him walk over to the, you know, in sort of the distance to the left and sort of sit against a pole. I didn't see a cup in his hand, and then Veronica Cartwright, you know, took her drink. So I wondered if they were suggesting he was one of the guys that made it out of there.
I think they were, because okay. I'll look it up and put it in the show notes, but the Wikipedia page suggested that he and Diana Scarwood's characters were fictionalizations or composites, but mainly comprised of two people who I think she got out, or they both got out, but she had not come to Guyana. Mm-hmm. I think the person he's based on survived.
But speaking of people who are oddly absent, did you notice that Jackie Speier was not walking through the airport with Leo O'Brien? We don't see Jackie Speier on, you know, the truck going in. We don't see her on the airplane going out. It's like, there. I understand that you can't have everybody and you can't have, you know, all that. But it's just sort of like that there was this powerful woman that was involved with the whole, you know, congressional investigation, and that she's completely, you know, disappeared from all of that, maybe so they could just afford Ned Beatty. There's something about that annoys me.
Yeah, I just assumed that it was too soon after what had happened, and she declined to let them use her likeness.
That could be, yeah.
But that was weird. I don't know. Their treatment of sort of Ryan's entrance into the country and the that one guy's like refusal to take the press with them mm-hmm. was strangely paced. Like, I thought that could have been a little more like forbidding, suspenseful. Like, even though you know what happens, I thought it could have been edited to be more tense. But
yeah.
It's a miniseries. I guess they had to fill time, which would explain why our final clip is, you know, this is just a snippet of a very long scene, and it seems to go on even longer. Let's listen to that now.
Are you sorry that you couldn't give that to him? To us, to me?
Are you sorry?
Answer our father.
I'm sorry.
Louder.
Louder! I'm sorry!
Well,
I'm so sorry. I'm snickering. I feel really bad.
I know. And I love LeVar Burton usually too. And this material is tough. He's not in a, you know, great position with this, but he's giving consistently throughout these tween getting grounded line readings.
Yeah.
And this, again, was not as effective as it could have been to convey Jones's scary control over a huge group of people in which who he's all, treating all like little children. So that was unfortunate.
You know, that said, you know, watching the miniseries again, which I have on DVD, I'll give you a side note. I haven't watched the DVD in a very long time. I had to figure out where the hookup was on the back of the TV and stuff. It was a whole big thing. And I'd forgotten about like DVD menus. So I just like popped the DVD in and then like went and took the dogs in the backyard. I come back into my back door and I hear like, so the DVD little menu, remember DVD menus, guys?
Oh, sure.
It's like this loud like chorus singing. And I'm thinking, oh my God, has everyone else in my building been listening to this chorus scream singing for the last like 15 minutes while I've been out with the dogs? So if anyone in my building is listening to this podcast, I'm sorry, you guys. I owe you a bottle of wine. Because it was like going on and on. But, you know, watching the DVD again, I was worried about LeVar Burton's character and I was glad that he got out.
Yes.
Like, I was engaged enough. I was engaged. Well, okay, I wasn't, like, totally engaged. Like, I learned how to make lip balm at home and some other things while watching this. But I still was, you know, it was on and I was paying more attention than I do to a lot of things. And I definitely wanted to make sure that LeVar Burton made it out okay. And by the time we got to sort of the final scene, I was locked in. And I do think that the final scene was actually, you know, which, of course, is the death, was handled It could have been worse.
Yes, I agree. I agree. I found this surprisingly good. It's not great. It is pretty long. There are some scenes that could have been tightened up, but for what it is, it's quite good. And it does a like thorough, conscientious job of telling his whole story. There are times in the first half hour that are a little bit, you know, Davy and Goliath.
Mm-hmm.
But overall, it's quite well done. And I am glad that we chose to honor Powers Booth's memory with this project.
Well, and one of the things that you and I talked about really briefly when we were talking about this in advance is, you know, just sort of the impact that I think both the miniseries and the actual events have had on popular culture since then. And I brought up the following, but I wasn't like totally kidding, Sarah. I do think that obviously watching this again, like a lot of the stuff that like the Joe character did was clearly patterned on the Powers Booth sort of portrayal of stuff. I do think that this offers sort of an endless mine for people who want to do culty things, right? There are so many little cues and signals that you can give without having to explain stuff because we all know that mothers, mothers, mothers now.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if you saw that. So if you remember the one reporter that we saw in the documentary, Tim Reiterman, so he wrote this book called Raven. that I think was published very shortly after the actual incident. I think maybe in the late 70s or the very early 80s.
It is sitting on my bookshelf in the to read pile. Should I go for it?
I think you should go for it because I think Tim's a good guy. Tim's a good guy. And he was right there and he watched, you know, he was writing for the Examiner at the time and he watched his friend, the shooter, that the photographer that went down with him, pardon the expression, photographer that went down with him, die right in front of him. I mean, this is like, he was in it. And so Raven got picked up by Vince Gilligan to do a HBO series. It got picked up in 2016. So,
oh yeah.
Yeah.
Is that still happening or did it get, what's going on?
You know, I haven't seen anything that says it got spiked. I sort of, you know, I followed links and it looks like, you know, as with everything with TV, it sort of moves forward incrementally. They were talking about how Octavia Spencer was attached. And I haven't seen anything that says that it sort of got dropped. I sort of assume if you get Vince Gilligan interested in something, you want to be in the Vince Gilligan business.
Oh, sure. But then on the other hand, he could just be busy. Better call Sauling. And that's fine.
But everybody,
yeah, thank you
everybody
for reminding
loves
me about that.
Everybody talks about, when I watch those Hollywood Reporter roundtables, about how working with HBO is such a different game than working with, like, you know, with the networks, that HBO, it's pretty much HBO and Netflix are the places where you want to go and do whatever you want to do. So I can only assume that, you know, it would be crazy to me. Everything seems to sort of work together with these ideas to, you know, not do, you know, for this not to, this just has to happen. It just makes so much sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so maybe we will get to see the Leo Ryan that we want, who now I think would be, given his age, Jonathan Pryce.
Huh. Okay.
He does a badass American accent. He shows up for that little bit in Glengarry Glen Ross. I think he's got it.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
You don't think he's too old?
I don't know. You know, he's like one of those guys that sort of has a, because he was old young.
Yeah, that's true. Because I was going to say, I think I would go Roger Reese in that case, but I think he now is too old also.
I don't know. Maybe I should buy American and there's some. Surely there's an old white guy who could do it. Well, I would say Powers Booth, but he's dead.
Okay, who plays Jim Jones, though, in this universe?
Oh, geez.
John Hamm?
Oh, shit, cute, Sarah, right? that's kind of amazing. That is right. Kind of amazing.
Let's quit now while we're ahead.
We should.
All right, it's time for our bolo section from our guest. Do you have anything to plug, Eve?
Well, this is not pleasant, but since we're already on a depressing topic, I thought let's just really go for it. So last week in San Francisco, we had a horrifying mass shooting. A guy named Jimmy Lamb shot several, I'm going to try to get through this with a straight face, shot a couple of UPS drivers. One of them was my guy. His name was Benson Louie.
Oh, no, and sorry.
Well, you know, if it wasn't my guy, he would have been somebody else's guy.
Well, but when you work at home, you become bonded a little more to delivery people.
Yes, and Benson Louie brought me a lot of stuff, and I also own a store that is across the street from my home, and he would know when the store was open to bring me my home deliveries there and vice versa, and he was just a good guy. There is a GoFundMe for him. It's just GoFundMe.com/Benson Louie. There were two other guys that were also killed in the shooting. And, you know, all of them had families here in San Francisco. All of them just, you know, touched an enormous number of people in the city every day. And we're all hurting a little bit over this, of course, because, you know, any death is a loss to a community. But something like this, where these guys would talk to so many people every day, it, you know, it really is hurting everyone. And so if you have a little bit of a cash to spare and you want to help someone's family out, like I said, it's GoFundMe.com, Benson Louie, BensonLouie. I know that his family would appreciate it.
That's an excellent note to end on, I think. We'll have that in our show notes. And next time, you'll be hearing Chris Huff on Aileen Wuornos, then we'll be talking a little bit about History's new limited event series, American Ripper, about H.H. Holmes. We have not had good luck with TV properties about this gentleman, so ably memorialized by Eric Larson. In Devil in the White City, let's hope American Ripper does a better job. Until then, I'm Sarah D. Bunting. I'm here with Eve Beatty. And this has been The Blotter Presents.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.